Coming up on your Novell Open Audio, it's going to be a long-distance call to Prague in order to speak with Jakob Steiner of the Tango Project and find out what the Tango Project's all about and what it's doing for the Linux desktop. We've also got Randy Goddard and Dave Mayer coming in for news from support. It's all coming up right now on Novell Open Audio. Welcome to Novell Open Audio, the podcast that connects the Novell user community with what's going on inside and around the Novell universe. I had an interesting weekend this weekend because something happened with my blog, which is reverendted.wordpress.com. I posted an entry just showing some of the new navigations that Novell's been working on, Nat Friedman's team has been working on for the GNOME desktop, and didn't realize that the entire Linux community would pick up on my one blog entry. I actually rose up to the top in the lists and beat out Scoble, so I mean, there's small feather in my cap. Scoble was very gracious about it. Now he's back at the top again, and once again, I've returned to nobody status. But my 15 minutes of fame showed up, and I'm happy about it. But this happened, and I think I might have tickled the fancy of a few people in the GNOME community and probably ticked a few people off as well. And that's just on time because I'm about to head to Villanova, Spain, to the GWADEC conference, which is the GNOME Users and Developers European Conference, and this will be an opportunity for me with their mobile recorder to talk to a lot of different GNOME developers, a lot of people have been involved in the project. Going to get to see the guys from Lug Radio there as well. If you want me to interview anybody specifically, I can do that. Just send me the requests to openaudio@novell.com, and I'll see how many of those I can round up. I'll be FTPing those back to Mike here in the Novell Open Audio World Headquarters, where he will be stitching them up into a few different small episodes, similar to what we did during BrainShare. So send in those questions if you have any. I didn't realize also that SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop was going to make such a huge hit on the net, but it's starting to happen. We're seeing just about every couple days now, there's a news story that rises to the top on Dig. There's the CRN, Computer Reseller News, article that came out recently, a few other things. I talked to Adam Dockstader from Mad Penguin. We had him on the show a little while ago. He says he's currently working on a full review of SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop 10, and he's targeting this coming weekend, which will be, I think it's right around the 24th or so. He'll probably have that on the Mad Penguin site. So check that out. Watch for it, because that's going to be a pretty big one. He does very thorough reviews, as some of you know. Hey, there's one other thing we wanted to mention before we start in with our interviews today, and that is that the SUSE Linux Enterprise 10 First Class training is now available. And the reason I put this on Novell Open Audio is because there's actually a kit to this. It's the full class actually comes to you preloaded on a 40 gigabyte USB hard drive. And this is pretty cool because it takes you through how to configure the GNOME desktop, getting into things like how to configure Beagle and stuff like that. It also gets into some of the multimedia capabilities with FSpot and those kind of things. It goes through OpenOffice a little bit. It covers the network manager, which is the thing that allows you to use VPN, allows you to use secure Wi-Fi, including WPA access and stuff. I just blogged about that recently. And it gets into also things like XEN, AppArmor, and those kind of things. All of this is in the $199 kit at novell.com/training. And I'll put a link on that in case there are some of you who are interested in this. This will be a jump start for getting into SUSE Linux. Good way to get going on it for those of you that are interested in it. And one other thing to mention, for those of you people who are members of Novell Users International, there is going to be a discount for Novell Users International members. You go to newenet.com and you'll find the discounts there. I'll link directly to the site on training off of this episode of Novell Open Audio. I know that's kind of like a commercial on Novell Open Audio, but I thought this one would be of interest to people. Coming up next week, we should have an episode of Novell Open Audio covering the Bandit project, which Jeff Jaffe recently announced. Jeff Jaffe is Novell's chief technology officer. Pat Felstead is one of the guys primary on the Bandit project, and he's going to tell Aaron Quill and I all the things he told us in the last interview, but this time, I vow to you, we will get the interview on air. It won't get corrupted. So let's check out what we've got with this show. I mentioned we got Jacob Steiner from the Tangle Project. The Tangle Project is a pretty cool project of bringing really cool-looking icons and things into the GNOME desktop and the KDE desktop or any applications that might be out there. But I describe it probably not nearly as well as Jacob will himself. So Jacob, how's it going?
Thanks for asking. Thanks. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for joining us on the phone. And we want to talk about the Tangle Project, and maybe you can start this with a quick overview of what the Tangle Project is all about.
Okay. Well, I'll actually start about what the Tangle Project is not about, because we get a lot of people thinking that the Tangle Project is about creating a single theme, icon theme that unifies that's unified across all the free software applications. That's not quite what the Tango project is about. We created or started the project to solve a problem for the user and also for a ISV or application developer who would want to create an application for the what we would call Linux desktop, but of course, you know, it may be more appropriate to call it free software desktop, because, you know, our graphical environments also run on other kernels than the Linux kernel. So the problem is that when you start your typical desktop session as a user, you're using applications from different projects. There's communities around that, and you start your browser, which typically is the Firefox browser. You have your word processor, which typically is OpenOffice Word. You have, photo editing, FBot or GIMP. You may be, editing or laying out your product brochure in a DTP program like Scribus. And each of those, because each of those programs comes from different communities, they all look and behave differently. And we wanted to define some sort of or spec out some guidelines what an application developer should make their application, or how their application should look like. So it's not specifically that we're trying to create a huge icon theme that anybody would be able to just pick and use. It's more about defining a neutral style that would work for everybody. Secondary goal to that style would be, because there's many applications, free software applications that run on different platforms, such as Microsoft Windows and Mac OS. So the secondary goal was to make the style not very unique, so that applications that follow these guidelines would not look alien on platforms such as Windows and Mac OS. So I hope I managed to sum up what Tango is about.
So if I look at it from an end user perspective, the things that that I see a lot of times, if I just use whatever distro that may have been pulled together through various means, a lot of times the browser, the Office package, and then third-party apps like Skype or whatever, every one of them has its own theming, every one of them has its own icons, and this is supposed to help unify that, is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, let me ask this one then. Is the work that's going into Tango, you said it's kind of generic, so it should work across between other platforms like Windows and Mac as well. Does that mean that there's any that there's not a specific desktop like on Linux, like KDE, GNOME, or Enlightenment, or anything like that? Is it supposed to be generic across those?
Yeah, exactly. We're trying to step away, because until now, we didn't even have like a strictly, I mean, the specifically defined style for GNOME, even though we've been, you know, drawing icons for years. So we sat down and thought that we should probably extend the human interface guidelines that we had and define the style. And then we realized that you know, users will be running applications or are running applications that come from outside the GNOME project. So while we would, you know, make something good that would make applications, GNOME applications, look consistent, it still doesn't solve the problem. We would still have applications that would, you know, look weird. So we try to go one level away from that or up from this and try to, you know, have or target free software, graphical interface, software applications, and not just, you know, GNOME-specific stuff.
And besides icons and things like that that are part of this, that theming side of things, what other kind of things? Like, I've heard things about common naming conventions and things like that. Can you give a little light on that?
Well, yeah, initially we thought that we wanted to make the Tango project a bit broader than just icons. But, you know, we're not that many people, so we thought we're going to go, you know, one step forward. So it's at this time it's pretty much about icons. So even the naming spec is there to make it easier for you know, different desktops to have a common look in terms of icons, because you know, when you start naming your icons the same way, and that also applies to the used metaphors, it's, you know, it's going to be easier to just have or ship a single theme, and it applies on applications that come from different projects. But it's still mainly the Tango project at this stage is still mainly about icons.
So these are other goals for the project over time that we may get into as we can try to build community around it.
Yeah, we hope we're gonna, you know, deal with also behavior and not just the looks of applications.
Now you have the tangoproject.org wiki that's out there with a dash between Tango and project. We'll link to that from the show so people can check it out. But I noticed that the actual icons themselves aren't really on the Tango project wiki. They're out there in CVS, correct?
Last week we finished the move to a different hosting that we use. So you may have caught the tiny little time frame where we didn't have the list of the icons online, but they should be there right now. But the thing is, it's not the most important thing about the project. The Tango base theme, as we call it, or Tango icon theme, is only a sample implementation of the style guidelines. It's something we didn't just like magically woke up one day and knew how to create a style that would work on all these platforms and solve all our goals. So we wanted to have something to like a proof of concept that the guidelines work.
Oh, so the icon library that is there more shows what the guidelines actually do. So
yeah, it's like you can use it. I mean, when SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop is going to ship, it's going to be using most of icons from this library. But it was mainly to see how the style would look on all these different platforms. I mean, we have we started to apply because now it's pretty clear that, I mean, not it's pretty clear, but we think that we kind of solved the goals that we wanted with the style, and we now started to apply the style on different projects. So now, for example, Andreas Nilsson, one of the contributors to the Tango project, made quite a huge, big contribution to the Scribus project that I mentioned earlier, which is a Qt application. It's used for DTP desktop publishing, and it's now using the Tango style icons in trunk. And there's effort now, we're almost done, to style the GNU image manipulation program based on the style guidelines. So we're applying the style on the application themselves as we speak.
All right, right on. So these the stuff that is out there, when people start creating, say, a library for the GIMP, you mentioned the new image manipulation program, when those icons get go out there, are they contributed back into the Tango library so that they become part of the base library, or do they become like a
So we have a side project on the Tango website, which is called Tango Art Libre. It's a like a set of icons meant for graphic editing applications like GIMP, Inkscape, or Blender, the Diva video editing tool, and stuff like that. It's meant to not only like share resources, because you know, you wouldn't believe it, but such a tiny artwork, and when you multiply it by the different resolutions and then the number of items, it grows quite considerably, but also unifying the metaphors across the application. You would want the same tool or similarly behaving tool to have the same icon across these applications.
Like a print button or something like that should be consistent.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, you know, there's a crop tool that should have the same icon across all these.
Got it. So if those if the Tango Art Libre stuff is out there, and these and the base icon library is out there as well, if somebody just wants to use those in a distribution that they're rolling of their own, is that possible? What kind of license is this stuff put under?
The Tango base library is actually a Creative Commons attribution share alike license, which it turned out some distributions have problem with. Supposedly, it's not possible to ship Creative Commons attribution share alike licensed artwork with GPL programs. But all the rest, the Tango Art Libre, the GIMP stuff, the OpenOffice stock is GPL or LGPL in case of OpenOffice. But the Creative Commons share-alike, we're in talk with Novell Legal, which are supposed to get back on us about that. So I can't really, because I'm not a lawyer to really analyze the problems that Debian Legal came up with.
But the main point is it's being worked on right now. It's,
yeah, exactly.
You guys are working it out.
Yeah.
Great. So what's the reaction been from like various distribution makers, whether they be community distributions or corporate distributions?
Well, the distributions themselves are kind of like more in the camp of using icons as a mean to brand their product. They don't see it much as a usability tool. I mean, an icon is supposed to, at least in my view, is supposed to convey a message faster than just a simple text label. So what they don't really, because the problem with that approach is that when you have a unique style of your icons, you better do a pretty, you know, damn good job of theming everything on your desktop, which I haven't seen distributions which would pull off that thing.
Yeah, probably like Ubuntu might be one of the closest, but even there you find a lot of things that just don't look like they fit.
Yeah, the thing is that you still can brand your distribution just fine and still follow the guidelines. I mean, nothing prevents you. That's actually what we do with with Novell, SUSE Linux, SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop or SUSE Linux, we have the most visible stuff like the folder icon are all custom. They're not the base theme, but they do follow the style guidelines. So
okay. Have any other distributions picked up the base library or any of the other libraries for inclusion?
I think there's some distributions that ship the Tango base theme by default, but I should have looked before. They're not one of the major ones, though.
Okay. So what about companies or entities like people outside there in the community?
Actually, a very, very interesting mail to the Tango artist mailing list, asking for somebody to work on a Tango style guide. Compliant icon theme for Houdini, which is like a 3D big 3D application suit. So that was the biggest proprietary vendor interested in the style guidelines.
It's funny because when you said Houdini, I don't know what Houdini is, but my audio guy over here, he just suddenly looks around the monitor and he says to me, "Oh yeah, cool."
Yeah, and they actually managed to find someone, so somebody is going to be working on that.
Great. So how about contributors outside of Novell? Has the Tango project managed to get some people from outside Novell?
Yeah, well, actually, the project itself has been kind of started by an external person. We talked about setting up or unifying something, sharing resources with Stephen Garrity, which is one of the Firefox guys, and also with Garrett Lesage before he joined Novell. So the project itself started to share resources among different entities because, everybody was doing their own stuff. But we also have quite a few contributors. I mentioned Andreas Nilsson. There's Lapo Calamandre, another artist. But we also have, people that don't really contribute artwork but are still valuable, making sure that the theme works well on KDE and stuff like that. So it's not a huge community, but we're happy.
But it is not just a Novell thing. It's actually got
definitely.
Some people from outside. That's great. If you're probably looking always to grow the community around Tango and get more people involved in it, what kind of areas do you need the help in most right now?
It would be nice to get the word out to actual application developers because that's what's important. I mean, when applications start to follow the guidelines, then we're happy. I mean, of course, that means that we gotta have either artists contributing, but you don't have to have a in the case of Houdini, you can pretty much get somebody to draw your artwork. It doesn't have to be a community member, but the result would be that the user gets a consistent experience on the desktop.
And that probably matters a lot in especially when you're going to have your applications running on not just Linux. It would help for Linux, but it would also help for if you're going to be doing cross-platform apps, maybe on Mono or something like that. So it's across the platforms.
Yes, exactly. Except for Scribus, there's not Tango style applied in Trunk elsewhere. But we're really close to getting GIMP use the style, and I'm really managed to get a glimpse of how that's going to look on Windows, and it's It's much better. It's looking much closer to a Windows native application, especially with GTK a theme that uses native Windows widgets. I can't recall really, but anyway, it really looks like a native application, so I'm excited about that. So yeah, definitely for multi-platform applications, going Tango makes much sense.
Okay, and on that, just a side question before I ask you my last question, and that is, how's OpenOffice doing as far as that goes? Because it seems like that would be a huge one.
Yeah, that's been when we started doing that. When I spoke about OpenOffice being a different project than the other applications that you run on your desktop, we actually, the Novell version of OpenOffice that we ship in our products does not ship with the original upstream artwork, which is more like Windows 95 styled stuff. So we recreated a icon set together with, of course, Michael Meeks, who's been, hacking all the stuff in, and Thomas Quasman and me. We created a set that would look like a GNOME application, and it took us 6 or 7 months to do. But with having all the metaphors in place and pretty much it's pretty much using the same perspective, I can say it's never, it's not a very precise number, but I think I'm 70% done with restyling OpenOffice in the Tango style. So it's not going to take too much longer.
Great. That sounds like it's going to be really good. So let's conclude with the last question for you, and that is, how does somebody find out more? How do they get involved if there's artists or ISVs or anything else out there that wants to get more information about Tango and maybe get into it?
Right. So pretty much all the crucial information is on our website, which is tango.freedesktop.org. There's also the old Tango's -project.org, and we have a mailing list, Tango artists. There's information how to subscribe on the website, and we also have a IRC channel, which we, hang out at and we discuss, if somebody has problems of interpreting the STAR guidelines or stuff like that, which is on Freenode. Also, all the information how to join that is on the website.
Great. Thanks very much for joining us on Novell Open Audio.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
And that wraps up our Tango project interview. Let's check out now what's going on with support. Let's bring in Dave Mayer and Randy Goddard. All right, we're back for news from support, as you couldn't tell beautiful music going on in the background here. Dave Mayer's with us. Randy Goddard's with us. Guys, what do you got for us this time around?
Got a great bunch of stuff. Obviously, the usual batch of tids, and Randy and I want to cover a few little things about making archives.
All right, take it away, guys.
Well, run through the tids quickly. I noticed when I was looking this week, there is a huge number of tids and documents regarding ZLM and GroupWise that have appeared in the last week alone. So I'm not going to cover all of those, but if you're using them, Zen Linux Management or GroupWise, go have a look at the tids in the last week. There's a lot of interesting ones there. None of them look too serious, but there's so many of them I just couldn't pick the highlights. Something new that's been published, the Unix Information Tool, it's a bit like the tool that we in support provide for getting configuration information from a system. Unix IF, it gathers Unix and Linux system information and Novell product configuration files, for example, eDirectory. So that's one that you might find support asking you to run as well as the config shell script.
Would a tool like that be good for doing some self-documentation of systems as well? I mean, could you actually pull a whole bunch of config stuff off and put it in your documentation book and tell the boss, yes, we're documenting?
Well, interestingly enough, that falls into the realm of the thing Randy and I were going to talk about. Yeah, it's a good plan to have that kind of information available. The config shell script gathers so much information that putting it back into place from the shell script output might take a long time, but at least it would give you a good record of the kind of things that we need to look at. And if we need to look at it, you can be pretty sure that rebuilding the system's going to require it.
Well, and it's a good way to get a baseline for your systems as well, so that you know, oh, wait, I set up this server 3 months ago. How did I partition all of these drives? And how did I use any volume management with it and so forth? And so the config tool that we provide, as well as I imagine this Unix IF, would be a good idea to have on hand and to have just in a binder somewhere.
Okay.
And multi-server environments where you compare two servers by comparing the config from them both, because we output the data in the same format each time.
Mm-hmm. And so I'll make the note right now to people and remind you that there is a news from support page that we actually update every time Dave and Randy come into the room with us here. And we'll have that linked from our show notes off of Novell Open Audio's website at novell.com/openaudio. And continue.
So there were a few articles, three of them, three TIDs, on troubleshooting the OES Open Enterprise Server Service Pack 2 patch process. One of them describing how to apply Service Pack to an online update server. But there's a little catch-all TID, 10100002.
Which will be linked.
Yes, of course. And, you mean you can't remember that?
Well, like it was almost something in binary.
Yeah, if it'd been binary, quite. You wouldn't have the problem. So that TID has links to three other TIDs that have good information about troubleshooting SP2 patches. Cluster service stops working after applying patches. The first time you update from a channel using red carpet or rug, and this was actually a call that came in to me, after installing a new server, all patches are downloaded from the channel. Due to a change in the cluster service's RPM, an older package is installed, causing a file mismatch, even though the RPM database shows NCS is up to date. Updating the cluster service's CLI, that's a command line interface package from OES SP2 media, corrects the file mismatch, and the issue is resolved for any future channel updates. So that was kind of an interesting one that came in to me. My cluster doesn't work, and I've got this old patch. When I update it, I keep getting the old patch on reboot. Another one that came in to me, Linux guests unable to communicate via the vSwitch on IBM Z-series systems. Turns out that an IBM patch was needed to address an issue on ZVM 4.4. And the IBM patch number is 10334. You can get that from IBM's support site. But, of course, we'll provide a link to the Novell TID, and from there you can get a link to the IBM site. That was an interesting one because when the customer called in and I took the call, they were describing communications problems, and the operating system was behaving as expected if the cable was detached. And it didn't look on the surface like an OS problem, but obviously the OS is the place where you're seeing the problem. So the first instinct is, what's wrong with Linux? What's wrong with NetWare? What's wrong with Windows? And this was a good example of a case where, when we look at it, it's got to be a lower level. We go out and look at the hardware, and yeah, there's a patch that fixes that one.
That brings up a question for me, though, real quick. From your guys' experience in support, how much Z-Series do you guys get called about? I mean, is it a fairly well-used platform at this point? Or
I don't get a lot of it. I think of it a couple during the year so far.
I think our frontline team seems to handle a bunch of it because, you know, Linux is Linux for the most part on any platform. When they do call us, it's something specific to the Z-Series platform. And I think we get a substantial amount. I'd say probably a good, maybe a good 20% of the calls that come in, 15 to 20%.
So there's quite a bit of Z-Series out there then because, I mean, it's not that the software has more issues on Z-Series, right?
No.
It's that there are enough people using it, and it's pretty serious.
And it's becoming more and more prevalent out there because of the ability to use a VM, a virtual machine, on this platform. You can have potentially, tens if not hundreds of virtual machines on one box.
That's pretty cool to hear because just from my geek angle on things lately, I haven't talked to many customers who are
you know, running the big iron systems and stuff. So it's cool to hear that there's actually, you know, SUSE was the first platform to bring, or first Linux platform to support Z series. So, I mean, that's nice.
You don't dress like you'd run in mainframe circles.
No, but I am wearing sandals today. You might notice that. I don't have the ponytail, but I got the sandals.
No pocket protector. Just for anyone who's using a mainframe, these are not intended to be offered as fact. Anyway, the thing about most of the calls that do get escalated to is the vast majority of them are PC-based, x86-based, and Randy and I work in backline support, so calls come into frontline, and the more serious ones get escalated to us. And the reason we get mostly PC calls, I think, has to do with PC platform having the most diverse set of features in use. Because there are so many PCs out there in the world, the set of features that are exercised in Linux is greater on PCs than on any other platform, and as a result, that's where we see most of the escalations.
And if you're going to be on Z-Series, you're going to be on tightly controlled configurations of your hardware, so that makes a lot of sense.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, what else?
One more that came to me. OpenSLP will not register services with DA. This was a case where customer was migrating from NetWare to Linux. They had a NetWare DA. They switched over to Linux DA, and all the NetWare servers would register with it, and within 15 minutes, they would no longer be registered. The DA would end up showing no...
DA is what again?
Forgive me, directory agent.
All right.
And it turns out to be a simple configuration file, OpenSLP, service location protocol. Net.slp.active DA detection if it's set to false. So if you comment that option out, then it will fix that problem. That was another bizarre one because SLP is SLP. If you switch from NetWare to Linux, it's got to be something on Linux, but it's not clear from traffic, for example, that the NetWare server isn't behaving itself. Customer was doing a complete migration from NetWare to Linux and doing it in stages. And at the stage where they switched over one of the servers, the one that was hosting the directory agent, this problem started to occur.
So if you're having issues with service location protocol as you make migrations over to Linux, look for that TID.
Yep. So I'm going to leave it there from the TIDs. Obviously, if you go to the support site, there's a lot of great documentation there. I could have printed out 400 or 500 sheets worth of TIDs before
coming
over today.
Yeah, maybe we can put a couple of the more interesting ones that you didn't get a chance to hit into the news from support section again. And so what do we got next?
So one of the things I thought it would be good to cover, I had a hard disk fail in a NetWare server at home. Hard disk was just at the end of its life and started to show corrupt sectors. So knowing I had to recover data from it, I pulled the drive, thought, well, what do I do? I don't want to do anything invasive. And for a long time, I've used a little Linux Live CD for doing disk-based recovery. It's called Recovery as Possible. There's a lot of great tools, particularly NTFS ones, for example, for undeleting files, where it's proved invaluable to me in the past. So there's a utility that comes with most Linux versions called DD. It allows you to duplicate one file into another file.
It's data dump or something like that, right?
Yeah, I should have opened the man page to get the proper name for it. I just think of it as DD, as I'm sure most people who use the platform do. You get to that point where it's LS.
It
doesn't need to have more of a name.
Some Linux nerd was thinking of foundational garments at the time.
So DD can take two parameters, input file and output file, and it will duplicate the contents of the input file to the output file. So DD space IF equals some input file, and OF equals some output file. Now let's remember, devices have files on Linux. Blog devices, disk drives, /dev/hda/dev/sda. You can duplicate a disk into a file. DD space IF equals /dev/hda, OF equals /dump of my hard disk. So a file gets created containing a sector image of the hard disk. I did that 4 or 5 times with this faulty hard disk. Then I ran a repair, a sector read-write, until there were no errors reported on the drive. But I still had what I hoped was one or more good images of the hard disk.
And that would have been really nice to have, because on one of the SUSE Linux Enterprise desktop betas, I ended up having a drive no longer mount. It was a riser partition, wouldn't mount, and I had just saved a file to it that had gotten corrupted or lost. That's where the problem began. So I did this repair, this riser repair tool, and didn't realize it, but my drive was actually having some physical issues on it, and the riser repair tool wouldn't work. It stopped mounting, and all things, well, I think the proper term is hell in a handbasket. I ended up losing all my data off of that, and you know, of course, calling our help desk. Oh, you're using the betas? Yeah, there might be a tool out there if you do some searching on Google. Hey, wait, I need help.
So I'd recommend the DD not be used to duplicate entire hard disks in enterprise environments. But if you've got a desktop hard disk of a reasonable size, great way of doing an archive of a critical disk, use DD to dump it to a USB plug-in drive and take it away. You got a great backup for the record.
You can also do a DD to an ISO, can't you?
Well, what you get is an image file. So if you took an input device that was in ISO 9660 format and used DD, what you would get out of it would be an ISO image. Mm-hmm. But you can't take a hard disk and just use DD to turn it into an ISO.
Right.
So I've used it at home. It's proved to be very successful. Just like to add that I have a lot of data that I can't afford to lose at home. I use an external USB disk now, a pair of them, with a USB chassis. IDE disk, plug it in, do a backup to that disk, unplug it, take it to the bank, plug in another disk, do a backup to it, and then week to week swap the disks over. I'm actually archiving somewhere in the region of 300 gigabytes of data at home.
All right.
So DD probably not best for the enterprise case, but as Randy's going to say, there are some great applications for it in the enterprise.
A very easy and a very quick solution for having, again, maybe a backup of or a baseline of your server is to DD the master boot record of your drives in a server. That way you have a backup of the MBR. If something ever happens to that, you've got this, it's only the first 512 bytes that you even need to worry about. So you can use DD to specify a starting point and an ending point on your drive or on a device, as it were, and copy that to a file. Along those lines, another thing that would be good to have is maybe a backup of your partitioning scheme, fdisk-l, and just email that to yourself. Another little bit would be if you're using any sort of volume management, LVM or EVMS, a vgconfig backup will print out all of the UUIDs as well as all of the sizes and the block sizes for your VMs, and then you can email that to yourself as well.
Now, you do realize you guys have to write this into a TID.
What's writing?
Writing into a TID, a suggestion of possible disaster
recovery. Well, I mean, you just gave a whole bunch of great commands out there, but I mean, a lot of our listeners may not want to have to keep rolling backwards and then trying to figure out was that a slash B or a slash D.
Ted, mortals need not apply.
I'll leave now. What else you guys got?
Well, I was going to say this reminds me of something that came up at a brain share I attended a few years ago. Sometime in the past, I worked a lot on Novell's backup technologies, and someone came to me at BrainShare and said, why doesn't Novell publish a sample disaster recovery plan? And I thought about it for a moment. My first instinct was, well, what would it say? For any simple case, for a real disaster, the most likely outcome is that no one's going to come to work. They're going to be looking for food and water, in which case, what does a disaster recovery plan even mean? Randy spoke last time about a technology that I've forgotten the name of.
DRBD.
DRBD. That's something where you can put your disaster recovery plan in a different state.
Yeah, I think you guys are thinking of disaster in much greater terms than a lot of network administrators will think of it, because disaster can be as simple as, you know,
server
hard drive
exploded.
Completely died, or, you know, you know, backup tape truck got...
Server shelf fell over.
Exactly.
Mm. On network administrator.
Those are disasters in the network administrator. I mean, the search for food and water.
Right, but I mean, I think that anybody who... I don't think that it's helpful for anyone to publish a disaster recovery plan for failed servers as an example for someone else to follow. That's something that's only really applicable at the individual level.
It's environment specific.
Yeah. But on the other hand, you go up to big disasters, of which we've seen several in recent years, then there's some major planning that is really worth doing. But if the planning assumes that people are going to come to work, it's probably not the best plan in the world. So just a little word of advice that came to my attention when I thought about it is, it's great. You got the plan. It's sitting on the shelf. You've got all the spare hardware. It's sitting on the shelf, but no one's there to install it.
Now, what did Randy do at BrainShare?
Rand,
because it was something related to this.
I was in the lab. We had
Oh, that's super. So it wasn't relevant.
Well, not specifically relevant to this, but maybe a different podcast we can talk about what we did. We had a great little application of real world technology and kind of applying to old world resources.
We are so far off course right now, aren't we?
Well, I was just thinking that, you know, applying x86 64-bit PCs to the horse and cart, it can't happen soon enough.
And with that, we say thank you for tuning in to News from Support.
And that's our show. Remember that Novell Open Audio is brought to you by your friends at Novell Users International in conjunction with Novell Incorporated. And all of our content on the show is suggested by our listening audience. Today's Tango interview, for example, was suggested by one Jorge Castro, who I owe a shirt to. T-shirt coming to you, Jorge. Remember, you can go to www.novell.com/openaudio and rate any one of our shows. You can also put in your comments on any show. You can see what topics are coming up, and that way you can send in questions for any of the people that we're going to be interviewing. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Oh, you're still here. Oh, that's cool. So there's been a couple of you that have let us know about audio quality things and stuff, and we're hoping that this edition, we bought a couple different pieces of equipment here, and we're hoping that that's going to fix a couple things for us. And if you heard this message, you might want to go back into some of our show stuff going from a little while back and look at some of our MP3 files and watch for some of the tags in there, because there actually is a hidden message in one of our past episodes, sort of like this one you're listening to now, only in the actual lyrics section of the MP3s, and nobody's found it yet, and there's a t-shirt hanging out there just waiting to go for you. Seriously, this time, that's our show. We'll see you next time.